Well, thank you, Kim, for organizing today's webinar and for all of you who have taken the time to join us today. By the large numbers of people attending today's webinar, it's very clear that today's topic is one of critical importance to many people. As Kim mentioned, I'm the Executive Director of NACEF, and I have the great pleasure of getting to work with programs CLEAR across the country. One of the things I noticed when I first took this job 5 years ago was how many of our members serve rural communities. Rural schools and colleges certainly face unique challenges, but I believe strongly that concurrent enrollment is a model that works quite successfully in rural communities, and we have success stories that need to be highlighted and celebrated. Our goal on today's webinar is to do just that, highlight some successful innovative programs and also address some of the challenges faced by states, colleges, and high schools looking to implement quality concurrent enrollment coursework in rural schools. As we have a number of people attending today from across the country with varying degrees of experience with dual and concurrent enrollment, I wanted to start off by reviewing definitions, as terminology in this field varies widely across the states. A recent study found that the term dual enrollment is listed in state policy in 22 states, dual credit in 18, and concurrent enrollment in 15. Note that this adds up to over 50, demonstrating the multiple and overlapping use of terms. This report also documented an additional 30 terms that are used in state policy. NACEF defines concurrent enrollment as college credit-bearing courses taught to high school students by college-approved high school teachers. Concurrent enrollment is considered by NACEF to be a subset of dual enrollment or dual credit arrangements, which also include programs where high school students travel to the college campus, programs in which college faculty travel to the high school, where students take a course from a college instructor via distance education. All these are other forms of dual enrollment. So we use the term dual enrollment as the umbrella term for any opportunity for a student to enroll in a college course while still in high school, and concurrent enrollment to refer to the specific model where the high school teacher is approved by the college to deliver that course. Both dual enrollment and concurrent enrollment are distinct from credit by exam arrangements. Dual enrollment provides actual college courses with multiple and varied assessments, and the credit gets transcribed at the time students pass the course. It is also distinct from articulated credit, which is generally non-transferable credit awarded by a single institution retroactively upon the student's matriculation for performance in a high school course. Now, in Idaho, the term dual credit is much more commonly used, while the term in Ohio that is most commonly used is dual enrollment, and both are used similarly to how NACEF uses concurrent enrollment. We, as the presenters today, will do our best to use the term dual enrollment broadly and the term concurrent enrollment more narrowly to refer to those specific courses that I mentioned. My apologies if I or any of the other presenters slip up at times. Now, before we move on to the presenters who have the very exciting programs to share with you today, I wanted to just give you a bit of a background and using some of the data from the National Center for Educational Statistics. This is the best national-level prevalence data that we have on the prevalence of dual enrollment across the country. And note that, as I said, they use the term dual enrollment, so this is broadly to any opportunity for a high school student to take a course. So, start off with, we know that rural schools, 86% of rural high schools, there are approximately 8,400 public high schools that are defined by NCES as rural. This represents nearly half of the public high schools in the United States. We know that nearly 90%, 86% of all public rural high schools have some opportunity available for students to take a college course. Now, it doesn't say anything about how many students participate and what types of options are available, but just the mere presence of at least one course is in 86% of high schools. Colorado recently found, for example, that the top 10 school districts with the highest percentage of high school students participating in concurrent enrollment were all small rural school districts. So clearly the model does work well in rural settings, and what we hope today to learn is some successful strategies for making that work. Now, this prevalence in rural schools is in stark contrast to advanced placement and international baccalaureate. This same NCES report found that only 55% of rural public college high schools offer these opportunities to students. These figures do mask some contributing factors, such as fewer well-supported dual enrollment programs in urban districts, or perhaps the larger participation rates that we do see in some of the suburban schools. Now, in terms of growth over the past 8 years between when the NCES first did this study in 2002-03 versus 2010-11 school year data, we have seen very rapid enrollment growth, the numbers of students participating in rural schools, more so than the average. I think the slower than average in growth in the suburban districts may be due to a higher installed base of baseline data from 8 years ago where those programs had already been much more commonplace. So we're seeing rural schools in some ways catching up. If you look at the total percent of students who are enrolled in dual enrollment across the country, 31% of students are in rural schools. This is in contrast to less than a quarter of the total public school enrollment across the country. And notably, this increased significantly between 2002-03 and 2010-11. So it represented only a fifth to a quarter of the market share 8 years ago and nearly a third 8 years later. Now, if you look where the courses are taught, you'll notice that over half of the schools that offer dual enrollment opportunities in rural communities are offering those courses there on the secondary school campus. We include within that career centers that are operated by the secondary school system. Larger percentage of schools offering distance education coursework in rural settings than in other settings, and this is something that I know our speakers will touch upon more later. And if you look at it by the numbers of students who are participating, you'll see that in terms of scaling up programs, if you want to get more students into these college coursework while in high school, in rural settings, 70%, 69% of students are taking those courses at the secondary location, again, including secondary career centers, whereas only 20% of the students are able to navigate that transportation challenge to a post-secondary institution. So with that, I just wanted to give that kind of context so that we understand that nationwide what we're seeing in terms of dual and concurrent enrollment programs. And with that, I want to pass it on to our speakers who are going to talk about their specific research and programs. Kim?
Thank you so much, Adam. So now I'd like to turn it over to Jennifer to talk about their recently issued report. I'm sorry, folks, who have been having problems hearing the audio, although I guess you can't hear me. I'm saying this to you, so I hope that those of you who are having trouble have been able to get in at this point, and I apologize for the trouble. Jennifer?
Jennifer, if you're having trouble unmuting your line, hit #6.
All right, well, thank you so much to NASIP for the opportunity to share with you today what we've learned about state policies on rural dual enrollment programs. So if you could just bring up the first slide on ECS. Next slide, please. Just a quick infomercial for any of those of you out there who are unfamiliar with Education Commission of the States. We're a 50-state organization based in Colorado. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan. We don't take sides on issues. We just present what's happening in the states, what the trends are, what the research says, and put that information in the hands of policymakers so they can make informed decisions. This dual enrollment work that we're doing this year is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, but we do receive over half of our funding from state fees. And we also received some support from other foundations, from contracts, from corporate support for some of our meetings. Our work covers the P20 spectrum. We have work from early learning all the way through post-secondary and workforce. And as you can see, our primary constituents, similar to our the scope of policy work covering the broad spectrum, our primary constituents are all types of state policymakers, which is really critical, especially around issues like dual enrollment, where it's not strictly in the realm of K-12 or higher ed, but it spans that continuum. Next slide. So I'll just give a quick overview. We talked about dual enrollment and ECS. I'll give a quick overview of some of the work that we've done over the last 9 or so months. We'll also talk about these different areas, and I see that some of the questions that some of you posted prior to this webinar fit very nicely with some of the policies that we looked at in this June 2014 report. And we'll close out with a couple of coming soon, events coming up. Next slide. So in December of last year, we launched a 50-state database, and many of you may have seen it, and it allows you to look across the 50 states and D.C. on a particular issue or click on a particular state to see all the 20 policies for that particular state. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see what it looks like when you click on Kentucky. And you can see here that in states like Kentucky, where there's more than one type of dual enrollment approach in the state, you can see where those programs differ between, for example, in Kentucky, whether post-secondary and or secondary credit is awarded. For dual credit programs, you get both, but in dual enrollment, you automatically get post-secondary credit, but the student has to apply to receive high school credit. So this can be a useful tool as you're looking at how your state compares nationally on different components of dual enrollment policies. Next slide. So many of you may have seen this report that came out in February identifying 13 key policy components to have a strong program that ensures program access and quality is adequately funded and so on. And this the report has also been extremely helpful to us because we've been able to go out to states such as Kentucky and say, okay, you know, here's where you get a thumbs up for having the policies that your students and programs need for quality and access, and here's some other opportunities you can look at to enhance program quality and access based on these 13 model policy components. Next slide. So CTE, it was interesting to see the responses that came before the webinar on areas where you're interested. CTE came up several times, and this report that came out in March is really just scratching the surface on CTE, talking about elements of state policy that states need to consider to ensure that programs are meaningful and high quality. There's a lot more to be done on this issue. I would love to do a piece just on rural CTE and some of the unique challenges there and how states are addressing them or local programs that could be ramped up to the state level are addressing them. Next slide. And then lastly, in June we released this report that's going to be the basis for my comments today. We looked at teacher qualifications and how do you ensure that high school instructors are qualified or provide those connections with post-secondary faculty to make sure that ongoing professional development is there. We also look at different funding structures, overcoming some challenges of program logistics that are unique to rural programs, and then lastly, looking at tribal colleges and how they can be a real benefit, particularly to areas serving large percentages of Native American students. So, next slide, please. So in our 13 policy components, we found that there are a couple that are real challenges for many states, and they're really critical for states to address. One is that the course has to meet the same rigor in terms of the same syllabus, same textbooks, all of these sorts of things, and that if it's a high school instructor, they need to have the same background and qualifications as the instructor who would be teaching the traditional post-secondary course on the post-secondary campus. And so going on to rural and how that affects rural programs. Next slide, please. There are different ways that states are going about addressing these providing qualified instructors. One is looking at reallocation of professional development funds. In our analysis, we found that Minnesota allows up to 2% of a certain pot of district-level professional development funds to be attributed to coursework for teachers, high school teachers, to take the additional master's level courses they need to be qualified to be recognized as adjunct faculty to teach dual enrollment courses. In terms of loan repayment programs, Wyoming is the only state we're aware of where they've developed a statewide program so that if I'm a high school teacher, I'm just a few credits short of being able to provide a certain dual enrollment program, then I can apply to the statewide program to receive tuition coverage to get those extra credits to teach that dual enrollment course. And the legislation was just enacted in 2013, but it's underway, and it's been able to put teachers into those courses in the last two school years. And so this is the second year that the teacher has been able to take master's level coursework towards this program. So it is starting to move the needle, and it's an interesting approach for other states to consider. We also looked at whether states are offering scholarships for high school teachers rather than the Wyoming program, where if you teach in a public high school for a couple of years, those costs are forgiven, an out-and-out scholarship. And we found some local examples, thanks to our friends at Southern Illinois University, or, I'm sorry, Southern Indiana University, but we haven't seen this program at the state level. And then there's the opportunity for states to offer courses through a blended model where the post-secondary instructor could be the teacher of record, but the secondary teacher is on the ground helping with that day-to-day structure that many high school students, particularly ones who are taking their first dual enrollment course, may need. We didn't see much of anything on the state level, but I know there are some local approaches out there that states could be considering for statewide adoption. And I have a question mark next to this rethinking teacher certification programs. I was asked a couple of months ago if there are any states out there that have a special, so if I'm getting my initial certification to become a high school math instructor, for example, is there a certification avenue for me so that I can take extra credits so I can offer additional types of dual enrollment courses? And the answer to that question is no, but it's a really intriguing idea for states to consider as they're possibly retooling teacher certification programs, dual enrollment programs, just to provide those course opportunities and credentialing opportunities up front when a teacher is going through the certification and pre-service process. Next slide. So beyond just allowing high school teachers to get those master's credits under their belt to be certified to teach dual enrollment courses, there's a separate question of keeping the communication lines open between high school instructors and post-secondary faculty from the institutions they're partnering with to make sure that they are using and understanding the syllabi, the testing practices, all these sorts of things. So I found a couple of examples from a couple of states with large rural populations. You could see that in South Dakota, the state policy requires that a faculty member in the discipline of the course must be assigned to and actively mentor that high school instructor. And then in Oregon, the policy specified that dual credit instructors engage in a variety of ongoing activities, including professional development, site visits, seminars, ongoing communication, just keeping those lines of communication open. Next slide. So funding, regardless of whether you're a rural district or a non-rural district, it comes up again and again in state and local conversations. And in our 13 model policy components piece, we recommended that students or parents not be responsible for tuition, and that high schools and post-secondary institutions be fully funded for the dually enrolled students. In other words, when you look at the books at the district level and at the post-secondary level, you can't tell from just looking at the records whether a particular student is a dually enrolled student or a traditional high school or post-secondary student. Next slide. And so to provide that tuition support for dually enrolled students, states are taking a variety of approaches. There are still 9 states where responsibility for tuition does fall to the student or parent. There are something like 17 states where it's entirely a local decision. It's developed by the district and the partnering post-secondary institution. But through these other avenues, some states have gone down to try to ensure that the responsibility does not fall entirely to the student and parent. There are some states where there's a state agency that is entirely responsible for covering dual enrollment tuition and fees, and the legislature makes an appropriation annually to that agency to cover tuition costs. In the second case, reimbursing post-secondary institutions in North Carolina and New Mexico, in the following legislative session, the institutions are reimbursed based on a headcount for dually enrolled students. In the next instance of workforce investment funds, in 2013, Texas passed legislation that allowed up to 5% of the biennial appropriation to their statewide workforce investment board to be reallocated to community colleges to support needs based on employer statements of need to support CTE dual enrollment programs. And then lastly, there's some models out there where a regional either K-12 or higher ed education service provider can support programs. And when I was talking to someone in Wyoming, they said that there's the two acronyms, BOCES and BOCES, in Wyoming to talk about the K-12 and higher ed regional service providers. And those have been one avenue in that state to offer dual enrollment programs. Next slide. And so more so in rural districts than any other area, logistics can be a real problem. There's limited opportunity for students to travel to the post-secondary campus, as you know. And this is where either a statewide video conference provider or third-party locations can really move the needle. And one question that I've been asked is, you know, what about online courses? And I've asked around for data on student success on online dual enrollment programs as opposed to at the high school campus or at the post-secondary campus. And there appear to be little to no data out there. And so the concern is that, especially with students who are taking their first dual enrollment course, who are being held to higher expectations, a quicker pace, different type of, you know, learning that takes place in a college course as opposed to most high school courses, students could really struggle unless there's that ongoing day-to-day support. And if you have a high school teacher who is available to provide that support in an online environment, then it could be feasible. But without strong data on success of online students as opposed to at high school campus or post-secondary campus, states may want to be careful about providing an entirely online environment for these students. Next slide. So speaking a little bit more about this statewide video conferencing, just this past legislative session in 2014, Utah passed legislation to create the Snow College Concurrent Enrollment Program. Snow College is a college in the center of Utah, and so it serves a largely rural student population. And the legislation provides for a two-year sequence of dual enrollment courses offered through interactive video conferencing for two or more high school sites within the state. And the 2014 legislation provides a $1.3 million appropriation and provides that appropriation should continue in years going ahead to support this program. And it also, interestingly enough, adds a component that not only are they supposed to offer a two-year sequence of dual enrollment courses, but the program must provide advisory support both to students and counselors to ensure that students and counselors are both aware of how the courses they're enrolling in fit into what they need for a post-secondary degree and high school graduation requirements. Next slide, please. And then looking at third-party locations, as we did our 2013 analysis, we found 10 states where the policy is really clear that a third-party location such as a career center offering CTE courses could be an opportunity for offering dual enrollment courses. And then I mentioned earlier the Wyoming example where their regional K-12 or higher ed education service providers in many states that states could consider offering dual enrollment courses through, so we don't have to travel all the way to the post-secondary campus, but there's a centralized hub for students across multiple high schools, perhaps multiple districts, to travel or receive online or blended hybrid instruction to support dual enrollment. Next slide, please. And so lastly, the last section of this report talks about tribal colleges. A number of states specify that either public or private institutions may participate in dual enrollment programs. Tribal colleges may consider themselves private or they may not see themselves in that statute. So a small number of states have made clear that public, private, or tribal colleges may participate in dual enrollment programs. New Mexico has gone one step further to clarify that Federal Bureau of Education high schools may participate in dual enrollment programs, and an expanding course location. That was in reference to in a handful of states, courses may be offered only at the post-secondary campus. So taking a second look at those policies and allowing 50 folks from tribal colleges to communicate with high school instructors to offer those programs at the high school campus may expand access on tribal lands. And then lastly, on providing state financial support, because tribal colleges generally don't receive state financial aid, they're not state-funded programs. New Mexico, a couple of legislative sessions ago, created a statewide tribal grant for dual credit courses specifically so that tribal colleges can be reimbursed for tuition and other course costs. Next slide, please. So in the coming month or so, we will have a dual enrollment data report, and this is a partnership between ECS and early tribesmen students at the UT Austin Dana Center, and we've looked at 13 states and what kind of data they provide on dually enrolled students, and it will provide suggestions for states on how to make those data more reliable, more publicly available, and more useful in terms of making program decisions. So we're really excited to have that coming out soon because we haven't seen any sort of analysis on the value of data and how states can improve their data. And then if you're going to be in Chicago next month for MESA 2014, I'll be doing a breakout session looking at state policy trends in 2014. And where we've seen states start to move the needle, getting closer to meeting these 13 policy components, and then also delving a little bit deeper into some states such as Ohio that have overhauled their dual enrollment programs and what opportunities those might provide for students in those states. So thank you very much for this opportunity. I welcome any questions you have, either offline or if you're going to be at NASEP in person in Chicago. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. You can see her contact info there if you want to shoot her an email if you have any questions. Or if there's anything you'd like to address at the end of the session, just stick it in the message box. It looks like we've had some good discussion going on, so keep it going. I'm now going to turn it over to Spencer to tell us about his program. Spencer, the floor is yours.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we sure can.
Okay, great. So just want to share with you some today of some of the best practices that we've implemented and found to be very successful in enhancing concurrent enrollment in our school district. And it's been important, especially in the state of Idaho. The Albertson Foundation is actively involved in increasing the number of students in Idaho that graduate from college. And Idaho is one of the last states in the nation for percentage of students graduating from college with a four-year degree. Just briefly, my background, I did spend 4 years as a high school principal prior to becoming a superintendent. And during that year, the concurrent enrollment really was one of our one of the highest priorities in our district, and it's something that we currently lead the state of Idaho in concurrent enrollment offerings. And just briefly, I just want to be able to show you how that's transformed. In our district, 14 years ago, we started out by just earning 30 credits for the entire year, and we have about 50 kids per grade in our district, so just a little more. 200 kids in our high school. We earned 30 credits when we first started, and last year we finished at the most ever at 827 credits. So as we've had the focus, you can see there the 2010, 11, 12 year, we really had even another increased push for more offerings of concurrent enrollment options at our high school. And just on an average, the average senior, not every kid takes concurrent enrollment in high school, but the average senior leaves our high school 20 college credits. Some of the higher ends finished with 50, and we did have one student a couple years ago who found some specialized courses online and left 87 credits. One thing that's important is we begin to market our program to parents and our communities. There's a little bit of pushback in that you're trying to grow kids up too fast and increase offerings, which we just, our opportunity or our responsibility is to provide opportunities for students to learn. But because what we do, we really broke down the Board of Education graduation requirements for high schools in Idaho and then show the similarities of college offerings that we offered. And just so we're not confused, that right there in the blue on the left-hand side, the English 8 high school credits, Idaho 1 high school credit equals 1 semester credit. And so each year they're asked to take 2 semesters of English. So what we say is your English, your senior year, you're going to pick up English 101 your first semester and English 102 your second semester. Therefore, not only getting your high school credit to graduate, but also you're also getting college credits for those classes. And those English 101 and English 102 classes are 3 college credits each. So just by taking those English, a student can get 6 college credits in English. We're also in Idaho required to take a high school speech class. Well, that equates to Communications 101 on a university level, and so on. You can see down there the natural sciences, 6 credits, the chemistry, physics, biology, geology, all those courses too. It's the same course. It's not an additional course for students to take, but it's really the same course you can take and you can get college credit for it. Economics is another great one. Econ 201 would be could be taken in place of high school economics. You look at humanities, a lot of high schools have foreign languages or arts offerings. Those can be transferred into those credits as well. One question we get too is we're a rural school district. We're located in southeastern Idaho, kind of on the Utah border. We can't afford to offer a high school chemistry class and then a separate college class offered at different times. So we put those classes together. And so if you're in a college chemistry class that's also a high school class at the same time, oftentimes the assignments are modified. If you're taking it for high school credit, you're not required to do the lab today, or you only do assignments questions 1 through 7 instead of 1 through 10. And so that just needs to be something clear that funding is very limited in all schools, especially in rural schools with limited resources. But you can offer those classes simultaneously. There isn't any reason that you need to add, especially in a rural school, a college physics and then a high school physics class and have them at different times. You really can teach those classes together at the same time. Kids can get the high school credit or they can get college credit there just in the same class with the same teacher. And then this is a little bit different per state on the high school teacher to adjunct professor to college status. Obviously, they have to be approved. Your high school teachers have to be approved through the secondary institution. And in some states, they require that to be master's degrees. Actually, in Idaho, it's not a master's degree, even though that's preferred, but it really is up to the local department at that university, if it's a natural science department, to approve that teacher as a physics or a chemistry teacher or whatever the department may be. And sometimes teachers want to know what's in it for them. There is, with the day and age of curriculum and implementation of Common Core in high schools, it's a huge thing across the nation that has a lot of pros and cons. There is college curriculum that's provided by that, obviously provided by the university, but also in a lot of cases, there's increased financial compensation that comes from the university and goes directly to the teacher. But also when students hear that we can take this class for college credit, it increases enrollment and popularity among those courses. And also those teachers, it helps them feel better about the courses they're offering as well. Now, as we talk about preferred methods of instruction or how that's going to be delivered, obviously the very first thing is going to be your own high school teacher. I know that's a challenge as we seek out competent professionals that can qualify to teach college classes in our high schools. It's been best for us to be able to have our own high school teachers do that. In Idaho, it's a growing trend of 4-day school weeks to compensate for lack of funding. We're still a 5-day school week, but the time you try to find another high school and broadcast to them that's on a 4-day week versus a 5-day week, or they're on a 5-day five-period day trimester instead of a 7-day traditional semester, it just really creates a lot of problems. So the first method of instruction for us has been your own high school teachers. We also, though, we do use what we call Idaho IDLA, which is Idaho Digital Learning Academy, which is an online only. It's asynchronous, meaning that it can be taken anytime during the day, whenever fits to your schedule. And that does have some benefits. But just because the schedule there is flexible. One thing that should be considered with an online option, or even when it's being broadcast, like we have the IEN in Idaho, Utah has the UEN, the Utah Education Network, which they allow classes to be sent and received. But if you're not able to get a teacher that's adjunct professor certified through a department, but they understand, have a good understanding of the content, maybe like a college algebra class or a college physics, you can consider picking that class up online, either broadcast or asynchronous, and then using that classroom teacher as a tutor. Because those concerns we talked about earlier, sometimes with its online classes that are strictly that way, there is a concern of kids being able to accomplish those. But it's just important when you're broadcasting, sending or receiving, that you're flexible in your scheduling and how you're doing that. One thing that we learned early on the hard way is the transferability of courses. When we first started the program, we had kids take any college class that we could get, whether our teachers taught it or whether we brought that in a broadcast or whether it was an asynchronous course. We just took every class that we could. And then we'd have kids come back that graduated a couple years later, and we'd say, hey, how's college? And they would say, you know, a lot of those courses that I took were a waste of money. We paid for those concurrent enrollment credits, and they didn't do us any good. So we really had to take a step back and really research the transferability of a course and how it would benefit a student. And even if that college credit was even useful, we had some classes that were college credit, but you go to a university and that class isn't required at all. And the day of electives is there's just not as many electives needed as there used to be. So we really worked hard to look at transferability. So if you can see the screen there, we have University of Idaho, Boise State, Oregon State, Utah State. And if you look at ART 100, that class has a different name at student universities, but it's transferable from college to college. Even you go down there to physics, there's a number of different names for physics down there, the physics 100, 101, but those classes will transfer across the board. So those are the classes that we began to pick up. And as you go, if you go to your search engine, Google or Bing or whatever you're using, and you just search, you know, Ohio State Transfer Guides, you can pretty much find that link, and you'll discover that some of the universities' transfer guides are much more user-friendly than others. But it will give you a sense of what's going to transfer to university to university, because not all students know where they're going to go to college as a junior in high school. So if they're taking classes, it would be wise for administration to consider whatever classes they're providing access to, that those classes will actually transfer and be useful. So the transferability of courses is just integral. When students leave, that they leave and they thought they're going to go to Boise State, in the end they go to Utah State or wherever it may be, that those courses have transferability. What's interesting about that is when you search out university's general education requirements, and you can just Google, you know, Ohio State general education or NC State, wherever you're going, and you can take a look at those requirements that they have for general education, and what you're going to find in most cases, that most Division I universities require a core of 36 college credits that every incoming freshman has to take. Now, that may vary just a little bit, but for the most part, they're similar. So that's why we emphasize so much the transferability of courses that we're taking and to be familiar with general education requirements required by universities, so that we're taking credits when kids leave and they go to college, that they weren't wasted money and waste of students' time. And that's just something that has been so key for us. One of the things that we do to try to increase community involvement and raising kids' interest in concurrent enrollment, because there's still a fair amount of kids that could take more concurrent enrollment classes. And we talked about the cost of college. And this came right from Boise State's website. Boise State obviously is an Idaho university, and in-state tuition for an Idaho resident full-time is just under $21,000 a year. Which is obviously a lot of money. So we're looking at nearly $100,000 for a bachelor's degree if you get out of there in 4 years. So on the next slide, if we just figure the rate in Idaho, it's a concurrent enrollment rate is $65 a credit. So if you get your 36 college credits done, that's done for a cost of less than $3,000 if you cover a few fees and book fees if your school district doesn't provide them. So just over two semesters, that's an $18,000 a year savings. And even in Idaho, there's been a lot of legislation passed the last 3 years, and a substantial amount the last year that actually begins to pay for a fair amount of those costs for credits. So just some great, great things happening that way. We use the cutoff of concurrent enrollment for those that can take students with a GPA of a 3.0. And it's important for parents to understand during our advising sessions that when a kid enrolls in a college class, that is transcripted on a college transcript. So if a kid gets a D in that chemistry class or that calculus class that's for college credit, it is going to cost them on their college transcript, which is going to affect scholarships and possibly even admitting into a university. And so we do use a minimum of 3.0 in order to even be considered. And also, teachers have great recommendations also of success of students. So realistic expectation, and when we design our programs, it really is realistic to say that when a kid leaves high school, that they should have close to 1 year of college done. And that, I equate 1 year of college to nearly 36 credits, depending on what a caseload or a number of credits a student enrolls in. And just a study there, I've cited the source there, but it states that we found a positive relationship between dual credit participation and both the first year persistent rate and the college graduation rate. So the idea there is the more high school credits or college credits the high school kid leaves with, the more likely they are to graduate from college with a bachelor's degree. So just some great practice there. And briefly, we'll often hear the argument of dual credit versus AP. You can Google that and find various sources there, but it really just depends on your situation. But in most cases, it has been our experience that dual credit works better for our situation than what does AP. AP classes, I've found, as our research in Idaho has visited with districts around, that if you have students that want to attend Ivy League universities, and AP is the way to go, but we just don't have a lot of kids enrolling in Harvard or Stanford or wherever they're going. They're more so just their Division I universities that take the dual credit classes. One of the biggest downfalls of AP, if a student's enrolling in an AP exam and they don't pass the exam with a high enough score, then no college credits are issued. So as invocation for stakeholders, it's important that we really look at where we're going to be in 5 years. The success and the increased offerings of a concurrent enrollment program doesn't happen overnight. It really begins to impact who we're going to hire. As we're looking through applicants, we're going to consider those that would be approved as adjunct professors or are close to completing coursework that they could be approved. And then where possible, it's a great idea if we can explore ways to incentivize concurrent enrollment teachers. And that concludes my portion of the webinar today. If you have any questions, feel free to call me or email me. We'd just love to help you with anything that we could.
Thank you so much, Spencer. We're going to move on ahead. Pam, the floor is yours. Oh, and you need to hit #6 to unmute your line. Pam, can you hit #6, please?
Can you hear me now?
There we go. Thank you. Sorry about that.
Okay. And I'm not getting the presentation now. Somehow I lost the presentation.
Let me get it back up there for you, okay? Can you see it? You are presenting.
Yeah, I can only see Spencer's last slide. I'm not seeing my slides.
It's just next.
I'm sorry?
Just hit next slide.
All right. Well, this is Pam Allen. I'm with Ohio Dominican University, and I serve as our coordinator for the concurrent enrollment program, and I'm also the liaison with the Ohio Appalachian Collaborative and Battelle for Kids. And I just want to emphasize that today I'm just going to focus quite a bit on how the Ohio Appalachian Collaborative and Battelle for Kids were able to increase the number of credentialed teachers and the graduate programs across the state of Ohio being offered for these teachers to come back and earn the qualifications. My colleague at Battelle for Kids and myself will be presenting quite a bit of data during our presentation at NACEP, so I hope that you'll be able to attend if I don't get a chance to answer all of your questions today. Briefly, the challenge in Ohio is that we really are trying to increase the number of courses that are being offered. There is a lack of access. We need to increase the number of qualified instructors. There's a lack of complete data. And probably no surprise to many of you, many of our students and parents still are trying to understand the benefits of taking college credits while they're in high school. And this is just a little bit of information about the Ohio Appalachian Collaborative. In Ohio, roughly 88-89% or more of our rural students do graduate from high school, but only about 19 are matriculating to college. Battelle for Kids has been collecting the data, and from 2011, you can see the increase has been fairly dramatic in the number of courses that are being offered, the number of credentialed teachers, the students that are enrolling. And one of the things that you probably understand is that once a teacher has become credentialed, especially in the rural area, for example, a history teacher can stay at their home high school and teach via distance learning to other area high schools. So they have a live class, and then other students are able to take that same course with them via distance learning. Another example is if the high school teacher stays at their home high school, teaches the regular college courses throughout the day, and then at the end of the day, maybe for the last class period, they will travel to a local high school and teach that same college course for that local high school. So the students don't have to travel. The teacher is actually doing the traveling. And there are many goals that the OAC and Battelle for Kids have established, but I'm going to focus on the one goal where they wanted to increase the number of teachers that would earn the qualifications to teach the dual enrollment courses at the high school. And in Ohio, the Ohio Board of Regents criteria for becoming an adjunct instructor is that a teacher needs to either have the master's in the content area or a master's degree in any discipline and at least 18 graduate hours in the content area. So teachers in the OAC were able to apply for funding to either earn the master's degree in the content area, or if they already held a master's degree, to try to get funding to have the 18 graduate hours in the content area. And of course, there was a process that needed to happen in order for them to apply for the funding. And the OAC and Battelle for Kids really had to identify the subject areas that would be most critical for them to accomplish this. They needed to identify interested teachers who would stay the course and complete the graduate degree programs and make that commitment. They needed to select teachers through their internal processes. And then they needed to determine if the teacher needed the full master's or only the 18 graduate hours. Now, I will say that many of the school districts had an internal application process where the teachers had to apply and interview. Those teachers that were selected then were forwarded to Battelle for Kids, who collected much of the same information. And then finally, they applied to each of the universities for our graduate programs. The key subject areas that were identified were these five: biology, English, math, social studies, and business. And then Battelle for Kids invited universities throughout the state of Ohio to apply for program development money to create these graduate programs and either redesign current graduate level programs or create new ones. And it was with the understanding that our degrees would be able to be completed in 18 months, not required, but at least achievable, that we would use a blended learning format. And this was also a competency that they wanted teachers in the program to achieve, and that there would be limited involvement in terms of time, travel, cost for the teachers in the program. An example that I'll give you is our Master of Liberal Studies English track. Our English faculty were very excited about redesigning our Master of Liberal Studies to include the English track. And they created 11 graduate courses. They're 3 credit hours each for 33 graduate hours of English. And this program began in spring, and we had about 6 or 7 students that enrolled. And we currently have 24, which is great, and we're very happy about that. And what's nice about our program is that all of the courses are taught online. Each course is 8 weeks in duration, so it's an accelerated program. And based on some of the student feedback, they were saying they really would like more face-to-face contact with our faculty, so there will be a blended course that we offer this coming spring. We have really designed a very teacher-friendly format, meaning that they are working full-time as teachers, and we recognize that. And they can take one course each 8 weeks during the academic year, which means they can really start the program at any of those 8-week intervals. So they can start the program in August, October, January, March, or May. And as you might imagine, summer was a very popular time for teachers to begin the program. We had 13 teachers that started the program this past summer, and they were able to complete up to 9 credit hours. The other graduate programs that have been developed through the grant are scattered throughout the state of Ohio. And you can see that the University of Toledo developed the Master's in Biology and Life Science. And as a blended program, the teachers will need to travel to Toledo this coming summer to complete lab work and research. At Shawnee State, they have created the Master's in Math, and teachers do need to travel there on some of the weekends to meet with the faculty and do some of the work. And then Ohio University has their Master's in Social Studies, History, and then University of Akron has the MBA program. I will say that my colleague and myself do have quite a bit of information to share regarding the student feedback and the faculty feedback. We have a video, we have examples of how to replicate this work, and we have a number of handouts that we're going to be providing during the workshop at NACEP. Our session is going to be held on Monday, October 27th, and I believe at this time, if it stays at that same time, and we certainly hope that you'll be able to attend. And if you have questions, feel free to contact me, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have either today or at a later time. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Pam, and you're in 2 minutes under the wire, so very good timing. It seems like we've been having great conversations over in the chat window, but at this time, if there are any questions that have not been answered yet, then please go ahead and type those in.
Pam, this is Adam. One of the questions that came in on the chat window was regarding using a sort of faculty development plan, and I'm wondering if the teachers who are participating in your program are able to start teaching the concurrent enrollment class when they first enter the program, or does it have to wait until they have earned those 18 graduate hours in the content hour area or the master's degree in the subject area for the discipline?
Most of the school districts are really asking their teachers and, you know, if they're comfortable to really start offering the courses after they've completed the 18 graduate hours in the content area. And that's typically because they have significant coursework. They may already have the master's degree in another content area, let's say a master's in education. Many of our students do have a master's in education. And so they really are trying to help them get started in offering the college courses as soon as they can.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Many of the questions that have come in have related to funding and the decreasing funding, particularly for smaller schools. Spencer, do you have any thoughts on strategies for finding teachers when you've got limited funding?
No, that's a great question, and there's no silver bullet to that. It's been something that we just try to think of in advance, even of years to come, as we try to have great relationships with our faculty and just try to get a feel for how long they're going to be working for us, and even look in advance and try to get a feel for that. But it's just, it's a hard thing. Funding is, I mean, funding is what we're limited by in most every case. The concurrent enrollment in Idaho doesn't cost us anything other than getting a teacher certified at that point, you know, and I imagine that's similar across the nation, but I don't have any great answers for you there.
So any of other presenters want to weigh in on that funding issue? Jennifer, I'm sure you've found some different models.
Well, I mean, this is Pam, and we were very fortunate to be part of a grant. The straight A funding really does play a significant role in allowing teachers to either gain partial scholarship dollars to pay for a graduate program or use a combination of funding from their school district. Maybe there is a reimbursement clause within their contract, or there's a teacher grant. I always encourage them to look for multiple scholarships if they're thinking about going back and getting a master's degree. Grant funding is great. I will say that.
Thanks, Pam. We're seeing some other folks chiming in with their kind of other ideas on funding in the chat window, so be sure to check that out. Montana particularly, we just tweeted about that recently, about how they're rewarding teachers with credit for credit coupons, so that is a unique model that a number of states might want to look into. One of the other questions that there was kind of ongoing discussion about was, Spencer, you had shown what courses were transferable, and in general they were all general ed coursework. You had commented on wanting to make sure that the classes that you were offering in the high school were ones that the students would actually get credit for once they went on to college. And we have a question about whether that sort of transfer guide exists for CTE coursework. So I wonder if, Spencer or Pam, if either of you have some comments on how CTE is going in your state, and if there are similar guides for folks to follow when they're trying to figure out what classes to implement.
When you say CTE, are you referring to professional technical education?
Yes, career and technical education.
Okay. In Idaho, the CTE, or what they're called an Idaho PTE, they're just not that transferable, even that useful in most cases. So it's something Idaho needs to focus. We're actually part of a charter school that focuses on the CTE or the PTE offerings, and built within that program, we have industry certificates that students are able to gain before they leave, such as a CNA or an auto technician course or something of that nature. But then necessarily PTE or the CTE credits really, for the most part, are almost non-existent in that manner in the state of Idaho.
In Ohio, the career and technical education courses will often matriculate or transfer to the two-year community colleges. Many of them offer the Associate of Applied Science degree programs, and so those technical courses may count very nicely towards a technical degree program. And it really, really does vary by university of what they will accept, at a four-year institution.
Great, thanks. Well, we're about 5 minutes over the hour now, so unless there are any burning questions that come flying into the message box, I want to thank our presenters today for taking time to share with us, and thank you all for being a very interactive crowd on our chat box. It seems like we've gotten some great conversation going. I'm trying to capture some of this so that we can look back at some of these questions and think ahead to further webinars that you all would like to hear about. If you have any ideas on that, please feel free to shoot me an email, kmobley@nasep.org. This webinar will be available online within the next couple of days, the slides and the audio, if you were having trouble or if you want to forward this along to colleagues or just want to re-listen to something, it will be up there. And I would like to invite you all to register for the conference if you haven't, and I will see you all in Chicago. Thank you so much.